All right. Good afternoon. Welcome, family. How are y'all doing? Yeah? Y'all look beautiful from out here. It is amazing. Thank you so much for coming and joining us. We're looking to really dig in on how to change this system that we're all digging into. And I just want to start off with recognitions, with acknowledgments. So first, we are currently on and occupying indigenous lands on Rumson, Ohlone land that have been and continue to steward this space and place for millennia. I also want to acknowledge the non-human beings and recognizing that we are on a coastal mixed pine, conifer, cypress woodland. And then that community has been stewarding itself for many, many millennia before we have come upon it. So I just want to recognize what's going on here right now. And we have an amazing, amazing group of folks that are going to be speaking truth to you. We have an amazing group of speakers of color. We have an amazing group of women speakers of color. And I want to recognize that this is not a diversity panel. I'm going to say that one more time so that it lands. We are totally in solidarity with the recognition that we need to address and speak about diversity and racial and gender and intersectional justice. And that is not the only time that you bring people of color onto a stage. The three speakers on this panel are the best at what they do. Three human beings, the best at what they do. And that is informed by their identities, by their cultural diversity. They do this work wholeheartedly, and they are mentoring others, other people of color, other women, other identities, so that they can also thrive and survive in this space. And it is really important for EcoFarm, for anyone that organizes and brings panels together, to really understand what change is and where we're moving towards, when we can have a plurality and a diversity and really recognize the beauty in all of it, and it's not just skin color. On this panel, we have farmers, we have musicians, we have scientists, we have medical doctors, we have artists, we have wives and mothers and daughters. We have all of these roles that are represented. Everyone on this panel is bringing their full selves to this work, and it's so, so critical. We embody just a multitude of expertise and experience and wonder. And I really want to cherish that and honor that. We're going to be digging into a lot of different aspects of collective action and food systems change. I'm going to do quick introductions. You can find these folks anywhere, you know, look in your packet, dig into bios, read books, do the whole deal. There's books coming out, there's books that have been out. So first, Kristen Leach coming from Namu Farm. We also have Rupa Maria from UCSF and a whole host of other institutions. We also have Vandana Shiva from Navdanya, from Chumakar, and a host of other institutions. My name is Samir Doshi. I'm currently the lead at the San Mateo Food System Alliance and also work with Community Alliance of Family Farmers and other institutions. And yeah, I just really want to encourage all of us to think about and to challenge where is it that we can step into more and more fully, right? Changing the food system is changing the human system. We are trying to do that through food. And so it's not just about how do we change our diets or how do we change our production schemes. It's how are we changing culture in so many ways. And I think that's what this conference is about. And so we're really excited to dig into this with you all. We hope for this to be an interactive session. We want you to speak up. I encourage those of you that tend not to speak up, but that would like to, that we will afford you space. We will listen. We will be patient. And we want to hear from you. So thank you again for coming. And Kristen, do you want to drop some knowledge?
So my name's Kristen, and I farm up in Yolo County, and I was really flattered and I think intimidated to be asked to do this with people who I admire so much, and I think that if you ask me just to explain to you in 50 words or less how I work for food system change, I'd be mildly stumped, because I don't think that's explicitly what I think about in the day-to-day, but I think probably like a lot of you, it's the challenges we're facing feel really overwhelming, and when we think of just like calling it the food system, it feels insurmountable in a lot of ways. And so for me, I feel like the work that Samir kind of wanted me to talk about was related to the seed keeping work on my farm. But really, I feel like the seeds are what enabled me to experience the type of transformation that even opened up like possibilities of thinking about how I could engage and be kind of a good agent of change, whether it's in my region, on my actual farm, in my ecosystem, or more broadly connecting with, the country, my ancestral land, Korea. Because I felt like once I was given entrusted seeds from farmers who it meant something for, I had lots of years as a production farmer and farmhand, and it wasn't until I started doing seed keeping that I really felt like something changed in terms of, receiving like this incredibly generous invitation into a totally different imagination and a totally different cosmology. And I think without that invitation, I would have felt mostly depressed and thinking about like, well, what can I do? I'm just a farmer. But even just seeing the sort of biological generosity and abundance of seeds and having that butt up against kind of the system that we live in that's really kind of founded on a sense of scarcity for all of us. I feel like there was just something that it wasn't esoteric and it wasn't nebulous or purely cerebral. Like it felt transformative for me. And even as someone who, probably got into this work because I had more affinity for plants than I did for my fellow humans, this deepening relationship that I had with these plants and these seeds and what it felt like it asked and demanded of me in terms of my accountability to them and to the stories that I was being welcomed into and to the people that preceded me that stewarded it really required me to be very thoughtful in terms of making them accessible to other people and to just ask how all of us are going to be better capable of surviving what's happening right now. So we do, a lot of seed production and seed improvement. Where I am in the valley is, of course, we're really concerned with heat and drought in the oncoming years. And so a lot of the focus on my farm is helping to develop more resilient regional seed sources while simultaneously working really specifically within the Korean American community to think about how all of us do that together. And I think that the unique opportunity that I've been afforded is working with farmers in Korea, where I was born, and the challenges that they face because of kind of the last 50 years of war and neoliberalism and just what has impacted that country and specifically small farmers within it. I felt just the unique opportunity as someone who really wasn't sure about what my relationship to that land was growing up here. And I think as I connected with other people who are part of that Korean diaspora, I think because we already, there was this existential dilemma of sorts where we already kind of felt what it was like to have lost something, like we didn't have this really seamless thread to connect us back to that land, we felt more protective of it. And I think that's been the whole point of our seed project, Second Generation Seeds, is to take the opportunity of what it feels like to feel the urgency and the sadness of that. But in terms of working with farmers there, to sometimes grow things that they couldn't just because they're under a lot more economic pressure. So yeah, we just do a lot of programs. We have a lot of fun. We make a lot of kimchi. And yeah, in some ways it's like weird to sit up here and talk about it because it feels so kind of small and so specific in some regards. But I know that kind of the points that all these other brilliant people are going to speak to, I know how it's kind of tied together in terms of seeing what it means to have culturally relevant produce available to our communities, because climate change isn't just this environmental devastation. It's affecting us in terms of our public health outcomes and who's sick and who's dying at what rates, who has access to just their basic resources. And so, yeah, I'm mostly here to just say, like, you should listen to your plants more because mm-hmm. I think they have a much more elegant way for us to kind of move forward. And that, yeah, just as a small tenant farmer, I don't feel like my safety in climate change is going to be linked to just having the best soil or the most resilient land or having the deepest well. But it's going to come in the way that seeds reproduce. It's going to come through that duplication and being one of just very many and just practicing those relationships, I suppose. So that's the knowledge I can drop, Samir.
So I'm so grateful to be here. Thank you, Samir, for inviting me. And I'm honored to be here on Rumson Ohlone territory. I was born on Ramaytush Ohlone territory, which is the peninsula north of here. And I live now in Chechenyo Ohlone territory, in the area known as the territory of Huchin, now known as Oakland. I am a physician, I am an artist, and I am a farmer's wife. I really, you know, started thinking about the wounds that are too great for any one of us to heal. The wounds that have happened on the land here when the land has memory and the land misses its people that were here, that suffered the atrocity of genocide here. And I believe that we actually can't move forward until we go back and heal that wound. And we can't move forward in any integrity until we understand what caused that wound, because that wound is being recreated every day in this culture. And by this culture, I mean this global culture of extractive capitalism and this culture that was exported around the world through colonialism. And so my work as a physician, healer, artist, thinker, mother, farmer's wife, is to really understand and draw these connections between the wounds and how we can heal, and to engage every aspect of my imagination. And that's one thing that I hope that we can do here together today, is because the task ahead of us is an immense challenge. It's a challenge to the entire human race. And what we will need to engage is our radical imagination. And that is something that we have not been trained to do. That has been something that has actually been very quiet in us for many, 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 many years. And so it is with that joy of imagination of how we can thrive together through working together to heal the wounds that white supremacy have created on this land, that 90% of the farmers who touch the earth in California are brown and black, but 90% of the people here at EcoFarm are not. And so how do we really look at these spaces of engagement to talk about food system change as structural change, because as a doctor, my work in the hospital at UCSF, where I'm a professor of medicine, and I work as a hospital medicine doctor, I see the end stage diseases of our society mapped out onto the human body. So you can see who gets sick and how they get sick. I started to get really interested in soil and food as medicine when I started noticing all these young people in their 30s come in from the Central Valley with bleeding colons. And I started to look at their stool cultures and noticed that the reports would always report a paucity of microbiology. So your stool is full of, I say, shit tons of organisms. And so the more biodiverse the organisms are in our colon, actually the healthier we are. And the more capable we are of fighting our bodies or resisting the things that compound inflammation in our body. So those microbes that are part of us, and 90% of our genome is from organisms that aren't us, which really causes us to call into question what our identity is in the first place. And so these organisms are there creating these anti-inflammatory chemicals in our body, specifically by their interaction with food. And these organisms come from all around us. They come from our interaction with each other, they come from our interaction with animals, and they come from the soil. And so as I was watching these patients come in, I contacted our gastroenterologist, who was my friend, and I said, hey, did you notice that the way that these colons look, their microbiology, kind of looks like soil that's been bombarded by chemicals? Like, our soils kind of look like these inflamed colons. And they said, that's interesting, Rupa. And then we had this rash of Clostridium difficile, which is a very toxic, dangerous organism that can be fatal. And we had a bump in the rise of multi-drug resistant C. diff in San Francisco, actually in communities around the world. And often you see C. diff in patients who've been on antibiotics, on broad spectrum antibiotics, or you see C. diff in people who've been hospitalized. But we were getting people coming in from the community with these toxic strains of C. diff. And I'm like, where are they getting this C. diff from? And so then I started to look at the microbiology data of soil and noticed that Roundup doesn't kill C. diff spores. And were we cultivating the toxic strains of these organisms that end up on our food in the fields? So were we, by trying to raise food in the most maximally productive way, actually harming ourselves? And so that started my inquiry into looking at the connection between the gut microbiome and the soil microbiome. And that started the work that I'm doing right now with my amazing farmer husband, Benjamin Farr, to move our whole state to prioritizing soil health as human health. And to do that by specifically supporting financially every farmer in California to develop a plan to move to regenerative practices that will build soil health, and to specifically outlaw any substance that will damage the vitality and biodiversity of our soils. And so that is the lens with which I approach my work as a doctor. I will take care of people when I see them, but really I'm interested in getting upstream of the disease. I want to get to the place where we stop cops from shooting brown and black people. I want to get to the place where we stop farm workers from being poisoned by these chemicals. I want to get to the place where we stop our soils from being degraded, because that's how we can actually generate health as opposed to simply treating the diseases. So.
Thank you so much, Christine, and thank you so much, Rupa. Yeah, it's taken me 35 years to come to this point, and I'm still learning. You began, I mean, with saying changing the food system is changing the human system. And I have watched the forced changing of the Indian food system to absolutely devastate our society. I trained in physics. I did my PhD in foundations of quantum theory. But 84, I really was forced to look at agriculture because the state of Punjab, where I had done my MSc honors in physics, had erupted in violence. It was actually a farmers' protest. but was treated like a religious uprising because it so happens all the farmers of Punjab are Sikhs. I then wrote the book, The Violence of the Green Revolution, for the United Nations University. And that then threw me into where the corporations wanted to take the seed, basically own it, make it illegal for farmers to save seed. They talked about intellectual property rights laws of WTO, of GMOs, as the route to patenting. And we are in a very historic place. I don't know how many of you are aware that the scientist who had done the recombinant DNA research for gene splicing met here in 72 and said, we don't know what the consequences of what we are doing is. We will call a moratorium. The scientist called a moratorium. The poison cartel and IG Farben of Hitler's Germany picked it up and said, here's big money. So I took a pledge, I'm going to save seeds. That's how I started Navdanya. And I think it's, you know, you bring up a baby, it's not easy work. There's a beautiful baby in the first row. You never say, but you bring up a baby. First of all, when you have the baby in you for 9 months, you're not grumbling every moment, you're rejoicing every moment. And then the baby is there, and sometimes it takes many years of your care, but it is the most meaningful work of caring for life. You don't say, oh my God, I wish I had a shortcut, just bump him off. You know, you don't have the glyphosate Roundup relationship with your children. Yeah. Just kill them. And when you think of all life on Earth as really interconnected Earth family, which is how I see it, and it's fascinating that when you look, yeah, when I come to particular places and like you recognize the indigenous tribes that were here, everyone's called an Indian here because poor Columbus wanted to come to my country but landed here. But he thought he'd landed in India and he called all the diversity of tribes Indians. So I always tell people like Winona, you know, his blunder united us and let's turn the solidarity into the ultimate step of decolonization. So I started to save seeds. We've created 140 community banks, but the farm in Dehradun grew because when I'd say, oh, we have 300 varieties, or varieties grow more than the high-yielding variety, and people say, can't be. We're so brainwashed, it was always can't be. So I said, okay, let's build a farm where all of this is there so people can see that diversity can coexist, that diversity produces more. And so we've been doing that for the last 30 years. But in the process, so much more has grown. We started to save seeds, so we grew diversity. But in the process, our soils are richer. And I want to share with you some data. This research was done by India's top soil ecologist. And he was the head of an agriculture institute. And of course, he'd grown up with the idea that only with chemicals can you grow food. And he used to look at these organisms more as lab, you know. But when I asked him, I said, come and look at 20 years of conversion in our valley, of farmers and our own farm. Just see the shift. Organic matter has gone down 14%. In chemical farms, it's gone up 99% in organic farms. It's gone down 22%. Nitrogen has gone down 22% in chemical farms. Gone up 100%. And the zinc and the magnesium and the copper, all the micronutrients have dropped and collapsed in chemical farms, which is why industrial farming is nothing but production of nutritionally empty toxic commodities. And 90% of it goes to make biofuel and animal feed. It is not a food system. We should totally reject it as a food system. It's a profit system. It's a killing system. It grew from the expertise of killing in Hitler's labs, but it has continued that killing on a planetary scale as industrial farming has spread. I'll have a chance to talk more about this tomorrow in the keynote. But on the soil microorganism, look at his mind just blew. Fungi, the beneficial fungi like mycorrhizae, have increased 6 to 36-fold. The difference between fungi and chemical soils and organic soils is 19%, and if you were to look at the graphs, in the chemical soils, it's all negative. both the nutrition as well as the life in the soil through microorganisms. In terms of beneficial bacteria, it's up 1.8 to 6.2%. And as you mentioned, you know, there was a time where there were still births taking place on the farms because these toxic fungi, the pathogenic fungi that thrive when glyphosate is sprayed, they were basically entering animal feed. And there were abortions. The livestock herders just couldn't have the next generation. New research is showing that when there's rich soil organisms, we have far more resilience in the plants. They don't get attacked by pests and diseases, which is very bad for Bayer and Monsanto because they don't get to sell too many pesticides. Now, I know, I've watched as I've traveled. I mean, look at your oranges. They're not near collapse. But anywhere where the monoculture has got intensified and the soils have been killed, diseases and pests are absolutely destroying, which is a market opportunity. I traveled once with a pioneer, 1984 famine and drought of Ethiopia, and I was working for the United Nations University. I'm traveling on the flight, and the guy next to me said, "Why are you going?" I said, "To figure out why, the famine." And I said, "You?" He said, "I'm a pioneer, and I'm going to sell hybrid seeds, hybrid corn." I said, "A, they eat teff. They eat lovely injera. And you want to sell hybrid corn in a drought period? Hybrids need more water." He says, "That's precisely the point. The more it fails, the more we sell." Now, in Punjab, where I studied, there's now a cancer train that leaves. Yeah? It leaves to Bikaner. And if you think of it, Bayer has bought Monsanto, and Monsanto is the GMO, is the glyphosate, is the Roundup, is the carcinogenic cases, 85,000 in this country now. And who sells the cancer drugs? Bayer. The more you get sick, the more they sell. So it is in their business model to make you very sick, to make plants extremely sick, to have bad seeds with toxics in them through genetic modification. And our challenge is to grow health. We've done a report on Manifesto for Food and Health, and you can download it on the Navdanya International website. You can download the data on what I've just read, the study. It's a Seeds of Hope, Seeds of Resilience report on the navdanya.org website. The data on the cost of chronic diseases now is for neurodegenerative, 2.4 trillion, autism, 171 billion, cancer, 2.5 trillion, diabetes, 2.5 trillion, AMR infections, 1 trillion, infertility, 3.6 billion, endocrine disruption, 549 billion, birth defects, 22 billion, obesity, 1.2 trillion. I've traveled in countries where, wherever there's Roundup Ready soya, the birth defects are skyrocketing, cancer is skyrocketing. And Bhopal, the city where in 84 the pesticide plant leaked, the birth defects are still there. 35 years later, 35-year-old children are not able to walk, not able to talk. So these are basically, if I was to define industrial agriculture, I would call it a machine to kill life on earth, to kill people and starve people and make lots of profit for a few people for a while. And what is the significance of gatherings like this? What's the significance of EcoFarm? To realize exactly what Rupa said, that when we grow organic, we grow health. I know leading specialists who are moving to organic farm, cancer specialists in Italy, in New York. They're saying we cannot solve this problem without changing the food system. And changing the food system becomes particularly important today because while we recognize this, the poison cartel is now saying we need farming without farmers. And they're then, because, you know, I went into agriculture in 84, realizing it was the ecological orphan. The environment movement wasn't bothered about it. Because the environment movement has decided that nature is out there somehow, not in our gut, not in our bodies, not in our communities, not in our food. So they had basically externalized nature from life, especially from human life. And conservation then became, where do you put people out of the land? And I just met a person last night who said, we are very worried, there's huge amounts coming for conservation, but it is all about emptying out lands of people. But we are emptying out our gut of biodiversity. 100 trillion fellow beings walk with us. Transform our food, make our brains, make ourselves, make our health. And we've desertified the soil like we've desertified the gut. And they actually have fecal transplants as a big speciality for the desertified gut of the rich north from the primitive tribes of the south. Growing health, then, means it's a whole different economy. That's why in Navdanya, we don't calculate yield per acre. We measure health per acre. Nutrition per acre. And our work is showing that where it comes to vital nourishment, we can feed 2 times India. I can be sure about that. 2 times India's population with all the nourishment we need. And not have every third Indian woman with anemia and iron deficiency. Not have half of Indian children wasted and stunted. I want to close because this issue of diversity, I think, is probably the most important issue for the human condition right now. And we are having, you know, you might have a superior race here, but there's always been superior religions. It was always the civilizing mission. And has always been the extermination mission. Otherwise, they wouldn't have wiped out 90% of the First Nations. That was colonialism. And all the people who died in the slave trade and the slave movement. But and the famines, if you add up the famine deaths of India, it's part of that colonialism. Mm. So we are having strange situations even in my country. Because the colonial mode is being repaid for today's time. And so, based on our national anthem, I just done a blog. You can go to the navdanya.org website. And I call it Growing Gardens of Diversity, Weaving Gardens of Love, which is a phrase in our national anthem, that people came from all over the world, religions came from all over the world, and Prema Hara Goi Ghata, they wove a garland of love. We have to do that with all beings, all species, all cultures, with the deepest love and the deepest respect. For those of us, you who want to join, you know, we've created a global movement across in India first. We launched it in India with a Sikkim chief minister who made his state 100% organic and a mayor in Mars, which is northern Italy, which had a referendum to ban chemicals. So we have a poison-free campaign everywhere. All food, all farming has to become poison-free for the earth, for the monarch butterfly, for our gut. And it's all one continuum of life and celebration. For those of you who want to be in touch, do get in touch with Mary Jacob, who's sitting in the first row and is president of Friends of Navdanya, a support system for our work in India. Thank you.
Thank you all. I just wanted to comment really quickly, Vandana, on invoking the monarch butterfly. And as we recognize the ecosystem that we're inhabiting right now, we are just steps away from the breeding ground of the monarch butterflies, just right here on the coast. So the first question that comes up for me, I'm hearing this connection and kind of woven through, and we talked about this earlier, between human health and soil health or ecosystem health, or even connecting with the seeds. And my question also brings into sociological health and the health of our society. It sounds like we have two revolutions that have been discussed here. And one is agricultural practices of moving from chemical agriculture to regenerative organic agriculture. And the second one, I would call the practice of agriculture needs a revolution. Because even if we move towards organic practices, they can still be co-opted. Right? So there's the control and power of that. I don't know who here's heard of Indigo Ag. Raise your hands. So Indigo Ag is a venture capitalist backed firm, works predominantly with kind of Midwestern farmers, is also active out here in California, and it pays people to engage in regenerative agriculture. Indigo Ag's venture capital backed funding is many times the size of the state of California's backed funding, all your healthy soils grants that you're trying to apply for, pale in comparison to Indigo Ag. And again, it's industry coming in and saying, wow, let's look at this regenerative ag field. Everything's getting hot for this. This is another space that we can move into. So it's not just agricultural practices have to change, but we have to look at a revolution of the practice of agriculture.
Right. I guess I see those as the same. So I see this as the same task, which is the task of decolonizing. And I think that starts with understanding that we're here on stolen land, and if we're farming, we're making our living off of stolen land. And the reason I think we need to start there is because the sickness of colonialism and the systems of domination that it restructures in us, between us, and between how we relate to the land it infects everything that we do and how we see things. So we are actually living in a mental framework in which there is no way out unless you start to decolonize. That every way you turn, there will be another system of domination that you have to contend with. And so what would it look like in your wildest dreams? What is this garden of love that we must weave together as people? How do we heal the wounds, starting with the wounds of the land and the original people who held it in ecological balance for over 10,000 years? How do we then enter the right way of relating? How do we call ecological farming actually farming for justice by moving together to give that land back and starting from that place? And asking permission to practice our medicines and practice our farming. And then ask for how do we even do that? Because you know what? We don't know. We don't know how to even imagine how to live without living in a system that is a system of death. And I think about this from the perspective of a physician. How do I decolonize my practice? My practice in medicine is rife with colonial language. Have you ever gone to a doctor and felt like they weren't listening to you? Have you ever gone to a doctor and felt like they thought they knew more about your body than you did? So the positionality of power is taken away from you and posited in another entity that is then acting upon you. And so that your self-determinism and autonomy and your dignity is never truly intact. And if you don't listen to your doctor, do you know what they write in your chart? Does anyone know the word they write in your chart? The word is non-compliant. That's the same word you'll hear from the police if you ever try to stand in the street and tell them to stop killing brown people. They'll say, you are not complying with the law. So you're non-compliant. And that becomes a description of obedience and power dynamic. So we are trained in a medicine system where, you know, it's no surprise to me if that's the dynamic. How many people feel like they don't find health with their doctors? How many people feel like they don't feel wholly healed in the presence of their doctors? How many people feel that their doctors are more biotechnicians and not truly engaged in the practice of enhancing their life and vitality? How many people are disappointed with the fact that they lose so much money? The number one cause of medical bankruptcy in this country is medical bills. So the same systems and thoughts that Vandana so eloquently described as systems of death and exploitation and extraction, those are systems that were put in place by colonial structures. And it's not just colonizing of, you know, brown people by white people. It's we have all been colonized now. We have all become subjugated to these industries and corporate structures and governance structures that leave us in an infantile position. And so by decolonizing, I talk about a radical reawakening of your power, to heal the land, of your individual power to heal the relationship with indigenous people, of your individual power to save the seeds and do this extremely important work, and then your collective power through working with individuals who are engaged in this way to transform the system. And so that is, I don't see them as two separate problems. I see the violence in agriculture is the same as the violence in medicine. I see that food and medicine were weaponized by colonial structures to keep us in a state of subjugation, a state of infantilism, like children. And what we see as an outcome of these practices is inflammation. And all the diseases of modern, they call it diseases of modernity, these are diseases of colonization. We're talking about heart disease, COPD, asthma, diabetes, autism, Alzheimer's disease, autoimmune disease, all of these, cancer, are diseases that we now know have at their core genesis inflammation. And that inflammation is coming from a disruption of relationships, relationships to each other, and relationships to the earth. Because the protection, again, from that inflammation is the microbiome, is our not being exposed to these poisons, and then having the vitality in us and around us to be able to withstand and to heal from inflammation. So that's how I see it.
Thank you.
I mean, growing up, I read Dr. Shiva's books like religiously, and it really affected me. And I think it was really like what you were saying about the sort of system we're living in and the role seed plays, and in the Green Revolution it really being kind of a Trojan horse that allowed the dismantling of these really sophisticated ecological farming systems that had lived for centuries before, you know, there was this different sort of paradigm we were applying to it. But withholding that and with really believing in the logic of that, of like what was driving that and what it allowed to happen subsequently, and that seed as this resource was able to really move this much bigger agenda, I think the promising thing is it can go the opposite direction too. Like seed is just as much a resource for all of us, and I think that what we're trying to do on the farm and what the people that most inspire me are trying to do is are those acts that it seems very small, but year after year, you were able to breed and improve. And I'm not professionally trained, and I didn't go to school for this, but through the act of seed saving and through just being like a patient observer and being open to being taught what adaptivity looks like in the face of all the stressors we're dealing with, I do feel like it's very optimistic, because you don't need a lab and you don't need to splice genes. You just need to pay attention to this sort of wisdom that plants are showing you. And so on our farm, we've been able to, just with very little resources, be able to kind of expose plants to different very informal experiments around heat and drought resistance, and being able to be put into our farming system, which is with no synthetic input, with the hopes that if we have this seed that is more resilient and represents the way we know we need to farm to survive, that resource being shared and being returned to a sense of the commons actually will be quite impactful. If it gives that same incentive, if it's that same Trojan horse that lets you actually farm in a way that your conscience wants you to, it helps bridge the gap of all the barriers there are, and how seductive it is to farm in this completely profit-motivated way, and just how hard the margins are for farmers. Yeah, because where I farm in the Central Valley, it's bare ground right now. It's the nut capital of the world, which I am actually proud of in this certain way. And the farmers around me aren't bad people, you know, like, and it's not that they just lack the will or the knowledge to implement other farming practices. It's that there is something very predatory happening beyond the scope of, our individual desires and aspirations.
while you were talking, Christine, my mind went back to the year 2001. We had stopped WTO in Seattle. And from the beginning, I'd been saying, agriculture is too precious to be left to a Cargill and a Continental, and to trade treaties for them to find bigger markets. And seed is too precious to be left to a Monsanto to own and patent. And we stopped WTO. But 2 years later, the meeting took place in Cancun. And there was a farmer, Korean farmer called Lee. And the march was taking place, and he climbed up this fence, which was keeping the negotiations and the protesters apart. He climbed to the top of the fence, stabbed himself to death, and said, WTO kills farmers. So I think the wound of contemporary farmers is important. It's important to learn how, where not to go and where to go. And that's why we do need solidarity. We need solidarity between the ancient farmers who were displaced from this land, the current farmers who are being uprooted. As I said, Monsanto's vision is farming without farmers. And right next to you, Silicon Valley is designing it as a digital agriculture. They call it precision agriculture. There is no precision in the clumsiness of collecting and stealing the data from farmers themselves and then selling it back as big data as the next commodity. So I always say they first said we can't eat, have food without poisons, without chemicals. And then they said we'll starve if there are no GMOs. And now suddenly they're saying that if we don't have big data, we'll all die. And if you think of the different colonizations, first it was the colonization of the land, and then it was the colonization of life, and that's why I call it bioimperialism. And now they're colonizing us and our minds and our bodies. We are the next raw material. And just that recognition of the poison cartel joining hands with Silicon Valley creates two possibilities for us. First is a new solidarity, because all of humanity is the raw material. The tiny peasant in Andhra Pradesh, where they're pushing a nonsensical zero-budget farming with digital agriculture, marketing for Walmart, seeds in the hands of Gates, and of course pretending this is something better than organic. Organic is worse than an atom bomb. That's the slogan in that place. So this new solidarity of the rejuvenation for a possibility of a human future with all the diversities, and this means that we'll have to have teachers. And I believe for food women and for the culture of the land, indigenous people, we'll have to be teachers. We'll have to start schools everywhere like we've done at Navdanya, the Earth University, and you can visit the website of navdanya.org to find out more about it. We need teachers everywhere, and we need other kinds of learning. That's what the Schumacher College, with Satish Kumar, started, and he's the one who bullied me to start Earth University at Navdanya. But given that Silicon Valley is right here, can you imagine if California led the transition to both stop the next colonization of our food and farming, which is taking place from here? Monsanto has invested in, I think, 16 venture capital firms. And they say the only two groups that need surveillance, CIA and us. And for us, returning to the land is not an act of surveillance, but an act of recognition of the sacredness of the land, the life of the land, the life of the seed. And I really feel if we collectively put our energies in a future for California that is not driven here, but that future is not a future for California alone, because Silicon Valley and the giants are invading my country, our villages. And so that solidarity is not just about the diversities here, but diversities across the world, and the defense of every small farmer, every small farmer, because they are today on the front lines of extermination. And if we can prevent this, we'll have food in the future. Otherwise, they'll put a few of us in detention centers, an experiment that's global now. Just build detention centers, push the redundant population away. and a new ecological apartheid, very big apartheid, where the lands are in the hands of a few, real food comes to the plates of a few, and the rest are fed what they call farm-free food and rendered meat like the mad cow diet.
I also think that this vision needs to transgress social barriers and professional barriers. So we need doctors and farmers working together. We need industries that haven't really stood together and sat together and worked in solidarity together to start making friends and pushing an agenda for health as our compass. That health of the soil is health of the people, and health of the soil is health of the bees and the pollinators and the water. And so I see this call for solidarity being something that we could each try in our own personal lives to imagine what is that person who's not in the food system but whose work is just proximal, who I can pull into this dialogue to stand with me. What is that person I know who's, or what positionality can I use with my privilege to discuss how we can support small farmers or the land reform around who owns land and how much?
On that, can I just say one thing? You know, I've done a book called Who Really Feeds the World? It was for the Milan Expo. And I had a sense, I know the trends, but I had no idea how much the landlessness of this country has grown, and most farmers don't own the land on which they farm. It's all owned by the giant corporations and the investment banks. So we are all bonded labor. We are all slave labor. And if you ask me, the radical imagination, I mean, I lived it with the seed, that we reclaimed the seed as a commons, and we have kept Monsanto. We've prevented them from patenting seed in India. But I think we need another movement that is the reclaiming of the land and the earth as a commons for the common good, for all life on earth. For all life on earth and all people. And my second radical vision that has been there since I organized the 1993 rally, where we said farming and food is too important to be left to corporations. And there were 500,000 farmers in Cubbon Park in Bangalore. And I saw that ocean, and I said, this is the way farming should be. At least 50% hands, and it doesn't matter what your background is. You could be a doctor in the morning and a gardener by the afternoon with your lovely husband. I keep saying this to the Fridays of the future. I said, strike on Fridays. Garden the rest of the time. Because we need 50% of human hands to care for the earth and heal the wounds.
It's interesting that you should mention the commons, because I liberated a song to the commons.
Oh, please sing it.
Yes. Well, it goes like this. It goes, happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. So in 2013, I recorded a live album and included Happy Birthday on it. At the request of our fans, they said, record us a live album. At midnight, I turned 30-something. And then they sang me Happy Birthday, and I wanted to include it as a secret track on the album. And so I included it, and my lawyer called me, and he said, you know, you have to pay $455 for the use of Happy Birthday on your album. And I said, what? And he said, yeah, no, that song's actually owned by Warner Chappell. And I said, what? And he said, so I said, that can't be right. It's in the commons. And they said, nope, they actually own the copyright. I'm like, well, what can we do? And he said, well, we could research it, you could pay it, and then we could sue them. And I was like, all right, let's try to liberate Happy Birthday. And what happens if we can liberate the commons, starting with the seeds and starting with the songs? And so we started our lawsuit, and it was joined by four other corporations who are all production film corporations, and we won. And my request of the of their settlement, $14 million went back to artists from whom they claim they took licensing fees. My simple request was that they make a public statement that Happy Birthday to You was forever in the public domain. Because to be able to wrest something away like that has incredible power for the imagination. So if you, if one person can say, forget that. That's not the rule. Like, who made that rule? They were collecting $2 million a year by claiming that they owned something that didn't belong to them. And so the privatization of the land is a myth that was brought here by colonizers for the purpose of furthering a system to divide and conquer us. So how do we heal what's been divided and conquered? We reclaim the commons.
No, I mean, I was just thinking of the issue of the privatization of the commons. So there's a book by Locke, and everyone's taught that in systems of governance. And he's talking about the creation of private property. Now, he's writing it with the example of indigenous people in America, but the commons are being enclosed in England, and he lived in England. So why on earth is he referring to the indigenous people here? But he's defining how property is created, and he writes about how it's created by mixing human labor with nature, but not the labor of the serf and not the labor of the horse, but the spiritual labor of the owner of the serf and the owner of the horse. And that's how colonialism created capitalism, created the enclosures. And really, our work now, not, you know, in the next few decades, I would say in the next decade, really, is reclaim every enclosure.
Yep, let's do it.
Reclaim every enclosure of knowledge, I would say software. There's enough of a movement on open source software, you know, on this land, on the water. That's something we have fought against privatization of water, and we won every time. I fought against patenting of indigenous knowledge through biopiracy, and just taking them on and defeating them has established that indigenous people know. They have knowledge.
And I guess what the reason I share that story is because you, each one of you, could pick one thing you love that you want to see happen in common, that you want to see us share again. Go find a corporation and find a good lawyer who will do it for free. Or do it pro bono, and sue them. And then if we can get millions of these lawsuits happening all at the same time, we could call it the Happy Birthday Movement if you want. But it's like, can we work collectively to dismantle the structures that put us in indentured servitude? Can we work collectively to insist on health care for every single person on planet Earth? Can we work collectively to uplift ourselves together? We can. It's our inaction, which is a tacit agreement with this violent system. So that's why it's, you know, even though it's overwhelming, even though it's like, what do? I'm just telling you, one thing you can do is pick a common you love, find a corporation that's claiming to own it, and sue them.
So I want to pull off of this a little bit, and we're talking about different ways of bridging collective action to bring about change. And so we've addressed using the courts with the existing policies in the legal system to actually try and advocate for the populace that that system is supposed to protect. And then there's changing the policies that then allow you to change the courts and subsequently. And there's a whole level of aspects on how do we engage in policy. And so I'm curious in asking, you know, for this group, for this audience and conference that's made up of farmers and farmer allies, what are ways that we all can engage in the political sphere? I want to raise up one initially, so the Heal Food System Alliance has the School of Political Leadership, right? So it's actually training farmers on how to actually be policymakers and run for office or engage in policy, recognizing that we need to take political power into our own hands. And I'm going to ask Kristen for her thoughts.
I despise politics, and so I actually, I feel like the California Farmer Justice Collaborative is something that has brought together, like you're saying, a diverse group of people who are kind of taking the issues right from farmers to the Capitol. And, you know, Janaki, who's my friend who is part of that collaborative, is one of the people that I just trust to actually do that, to represent farmers and, yeah, kind of speak from our voices, so.
Yeah.
I don't know, very explicitly policy, I guess.
Okay, that's legit. Other thoughts on how farmers can engage in policy or in politics, or those that are trying to support farmers?
Well, I think the first thing we have to recognize is that part of deep democracy is reclaiming the setting of policy and making decisions in community for the commons. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it might need a recognition, but very often it might need a disobedience. So in India, at least, all the changes we've made have been a combination. If, you know, if the government's willing to work with us, I write a law that says plants, animals, and seeds are not human inventions. Therefore, Monsanto can't have a patent on it. But on the days where they pass a law to help Monsanto, we do civil disobedience and what Gandhi called the satyagraha. But what we knowing that we are in times where all our governments at the higher level, at the central level, are captive, we know that at the local level, more and more people are entering politics in order to keep democracy alive. So that one of the most radical groups of people are mayors. I work with them. They're organized. When Trump said, I will walk out of Paris, all the mayors joined. And the commitments they've made and the decisions they've made are way beyond any national government could make. But even deeper than local government or regional government, I would add to that, is the fact that you can't reclaim the commons without rebuilding community. You can't rebuild community without taking back power. And the way we've done that in India is through building the living democracy movement. We just say, okay, we're part of this earth, these forests, these rivers, these seeds, this land is our commons. We're going to defend it. And this fact has prevented privatization of water, has prevented entry of chemicals into the regions, has prevented the GMOs. And that collective determination is, in my view, the most important aspect of what we need for democracy today.
Thank you. I would love to open it up. We have a microphone right here, so if you have questions, we would love to hear them. Please let your voice be heard. While we're doing that, I want to just seed a question for you all, and kind of coming back to what Rupa opened up with. We're dealing with like a lot of heavy issues, and it's, you know, I mean, this is a lot of really deep work and heavy shit, and, you know, excuse me, Vandana Auntie.
Yes.
So where do you all draw inspiration from? Like, where is the source that you're bringing to this work, to this struggle? Where's that coming from?
It comes from my righteous, beautiful farmer man. It comes from my children, my beautiful sons. It comes from the beauty of Ohlone territory and the friendships I've made with indigenous people. It comes from the beautiful white community who hold me up in the work that I do, unflinchingly standing by me. It comes from my black and brown brothers and sisters who stand with me on the front line as we take the blows from the police. It comes from all of those experiences because I see in that radical love and radical faith that we will win because we are on the side of righteousness and
love and health. And so I think that critical political organization, and by that I mean direct action, learning how to organize, learning how to take over a vacant house in East Oakland to force a point. Learning how to expose the violence of the state when mothers are just trying to avoid being raped on the streets of Oakland in front of their children. Learning how to expose that through the taking over and inhabiting and occupying of space and forcing the issue. Exposing the moral dilemmas with our bodies and our solidarity. And so I think that really learning how to organize is critical and crucial. And there's lots of us who would love to do that with you. Because I truly believe the farmers who are holding this vision of healing the earth are the keepers of our health. You guys, I can fix what's broken. You guys are the ones who make sure it doesn't get broken. So I want to support that with every ounce of energy I have.
Thank you. Farmer Kristen.
What's your inspiration? Well, I agree with everything Rupa just said. That's all pretty inspiring. I don't have a farmer man husband, but I do have a somatic therapist wife who's really amazing. And I think, yeah, I mean, it's a pretty good deal to be married to a therapist. Maybe not for the therapist, but it's really good for me and grounding. And yeah, I mean, I love my community. I think that, you know, as scary as things have been in the past few years and just, you know, being surrounded and watching people be displaced by fire, I think the comforting feeling is just that I'm like kind of ride or die for this area and for my region and for the people that I love and care about. And then there's just so many kids in my life that are really inspiring, like on a deeply visceral level. We have a harvest festival each year, and the seed saving class is always taught by people who are 6 and under. And it's like real, it's not like novel or cute. Like they will correct you about winnowing and you're using the wrong screen or you're doing a sloppy job. Like they're really on top of it. They're really incredible. But yeah, I think that cadre of young people and just kind of seeing that is really hopeful, just because they're not unlearning as much as some of us have had to unlearn in our lives. And there's just a different starting point where vegetables are delicious and plants are our kin and the places that we occupy we have a huge responsibility to, and that we're part of something and not the dominators of it. And so, I think that when things feel really hard, I'm really lucky to have those people in my life.
One minute. Where do you draw inspiration?
You know, I never had the illusion that we are atlases carrying the earth on our shoulders. I realized we are part of an amazing earth, a very generous, very loving Mother Earth. And that has been my inspiration from very early. And that's why I joined the Chipko movement for hugging the trees in the 70s. I've received a lot of inspiration from particularly peasant women. They might have a flood and they're right back the next year. They might have had a drought and they never give up hope. They never give up their commitment that there is a future. And I remember particularly, you know, in the time when we were stopping the mining and there was a mine where the women had come out to do the Chipko, the direct action. And the goons of the miners came and beat them up with iron rods and trashed them. And when I got the message, I went to the village. And they were right back at the camp, bandaged, plasters, preventing the bulldozers from coming. And I asked Litvari Devi, who's no more, and I asked her, the question you asked is, where do you get this courage, you know? You've just been beaten up and you're still here. And she said, you see the trees, I take the leaves to feed my animals. And the tree and the leaves come right back. We're walking on the grass. The grass will come right back. That resilience is us because we are not separate from nature.
Hello, can you please state your name, all of you that are asking questions as well, so we can deepen in relationship with you?
Yeah. Hi, good afternoon, everybody, and good afternoon, panelists. My name is Sainath Suryanarayanan. You can call me Sai. And I'm a social scientist and a biologist and an author of the book Vanishing Bees, Science, Politics, and Honeybee Health. I'm humbled and inspired, I think as we all are, by our panelists. So thank you so much for sharing your insights and perspectives. I have a question for Dr. Shiva, mainly, but everybody else can answer too, which is if you could expand on your notion of diversity, since you talked about diversity as the crux issue today. And I'm thinking in particular about the kind of gaslighting that comes from agrochemical industry around diversity, which is that, well, genetically engineered tools are one in a tool kit of other kinds of tools. You have agroecology, you have biodynamic agriculture or regenerative agriculture, and you have GMOs. So why can't we all coexist happily together in this notion of diversity? Why exclude GE or GM tools is the kind of gaslighting that is happening or has happened. I've heard Monsanto officials talk about diversity in that way. And so it's become weaponized. So if you could then expand on your notion of diversity with that in mind. And then I'll just very quickly say, as a 15-year-old, I saw you, Dr. Shiva, in Delhi, as a student who was taken from his school in Delhi for this for a debate feature about genetics and gene engineering. And you were there, and I was in the audience, and it stayed as a lifelong inspiration. So thank you. Aww.
You make me feel like the old growth forest. But I will keep in mind the time as much as, you know, the question you asked, and we can talk later to elaborate it much more. First of all, deploying a tool that is based on biopiracy of the one hand, you know, they have to pirate soil organisms, every genetically modified organism. Either a BT toxin taken from the soil, they won't ask permission. You have antibiotic resistance markers taken from the soil. So the system itself is piracy and therefore cannot be the respecting of piracy. But most importantly, we do know contamination is inevitable. So coexistence is impossible. The organic farm does not have a chance to stay organic if GMO canola or GMO corn comes up. This has happened again and again and again. The Percy Spicer case in Canada, the Australian organic farmers case, again in the case of canola. But this contamination shows that there's nothing like coexistence. There is much more the issue of pollution and much more the issue of extermination of the diversity. Because, you know, I was part of drafting the framework for biosafety at the international level as a protocol for the Convention on Biological Diversity. And we didn't know exactly what GMOs would do in the environment. But we did know that they will cause impact. And so we said ecological impact on biodiversity has to be part of that assessment. Impact on farmers and their livelihoods has to be part of the assessment. And impact on public health has to be part of the assessment. And when they attack those who want safety assessments, as if they're anti-science, they basically want no regulation, and your current government is rushing ahead trying to dismantle every little pieces of legislation that are there to protect the environment and public health. So these are not tools that sit. They produce genes. They produce seeds. They produce crops. There's interaction. So foundationally, I don't see diversity as an arithmetic collection of disconnected objects or disconnected tools. I see it as the deep relationship between diverse beings. So I want to read your book on the bee, but you know, for me, diversity is the relationship of the bee and the flower. But of course, the diversity of flowers and the diversity of bees. But without that relationship, you cannot have diversity. Without that interconnectedness, you can't have diversity. And respect for that interconnectedness is respect for diversity.
Hi, my name's Andrea Hatsukami. I'm a livestock apprentice on a cattle ranch. And I was wondering, when you talk about bringing more people in different industries into this sort of revolution that's happening, I think that farming and ranching is a practice and an industry that's not thought of as profitable. And it's not something, it's something you'd have to work hard at and be very, very smart, work very smart at, in order to make a profit. And I think for industries that profit off of the capitalist system as it stands right now and off of the power system that we live inside of, how do you think the best way to encourage those people who work in those industries to join, to revolutionize the system that we live within? Because they already benefit from it.
That's a really great question. So I think a good place to start, if I might suggest, is with doctors. So I'm employed by the state of California to take care of anyone who comes through the doors of UC Hospital. I can't deny care to anybody. I'm a public servant. I would love to see our farmers be public servants. I would love to see food be liberated from the capitalist system. I would love to see farmers paid the way I'm paid, a lovely salary, because you are the stewards of our health. You are the stewards of our planet. You are the stewards of our soils and our waters. So I can imagine a system, my radical imagination, where that food that's created is given to the people for their health. That we have food pharmacies in every clinic across our state. That everyone has access to nutritious food grown in a regenerative, organic, healthy production system. And so that's what I would love to see. I would love to see the way that, you know, our society is organized right now, where the people who have the most critical jobs, like mothers, like, you know, bringing forth the entire human race through our vaginas, that's like no small task, right? No political power. Women, no parity in our pay. No benefits. Land ownership on planet Earth, almost exclusively in the hands of men. So I think that partnering with maybe not people who are diehard capitalists, but people who can imagine a world outside of capitalism. Rajan, when Vandana was talking about the deep interrelating being the diversity. To me, I see decolonizing as relationship. So if to colonize is to divide and conquer, to decolonize is to heal and reconnect. And so how do we find those strategic partnerships? Right now, as a range person, your work is critical for carbon sequestration in the state of California, how you manage your work. There are plenty of people who are very interested in that, in whether it's foundations, people who want to move California off of fossil fuels, people and groups who want to look at soil health and human health. So maybe start with doctors, start with me, start with people in those, maybe. That's just a humble suggestion. Thank you for your work.
Thank you. That's right.
Just because we're getting short on time, we might take a few questions, but please, again, state your name and your question, and then we can respond to them in groups.
Connectively.
Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. My name is Zion. I've been following all of your work for many years now, and so just super humbled to be in your presence. My question is, I've been studying a bit about what happened in Kerala, where there was relationships that were cultivated between hospitals and small, organic, regenerative farmers, and I've been learning about that a bit and about how there were farm cooperatives that were formed between low-income farmers in that area, and through their cooperatives, they were able to create partnerships with hospitals that were looking to increase the nutrient density in the foods that were being offered. And yeah, at this gathering, I feel like there's a coming together of a lot of souls who can facilitate something similar to like that happening in the Bay Area, particularly with the focus on decolonization and reparations and land reclamation. And so I'm curious about the ways to potentially weave that together and also potentially to harvest the lessons from how those efforts are currently going and any pitfalls or challenges that those communities may have faced in their process of seeking that freedom.
Thank you. We can just finish also just with the rest of the questions in the queue and then just take them all together.
Hi, my name is Kendra Johnson. Again, likewise, it's an honor to hear all of you speak today. I was so happy to hear all of this energy. I'm, first of all, astounded by the energy in this room, the amount of turnout that shows what an important topic this is. The mention of the commons and of diversity and how I'm noticing those coming together. We must work on protecting the diversity of our crops, the diversity of the ecological systems upon which good agriculture depends, the diversity of the scales, I believe, of the way that agriculture is operated, and that's something that we're losing very, very, very quickly. We have lots of tiny farms and lots of very large farms, and we're losing diversity of scale. We're also going in the wrong direction in terms of diversity of ownership, and that was spoken of today. So I come here with Agrarian Trust forming agrarian commons around the country for this very reason, which is how can we begin to build small nucleuses of commonly held farm land, these hubs of places that are collectively owned, but also provide for independent entrepreneurial and right kind of agriculture. So I'd love to continue the conversation on the commons, hear how that can begin to change diversity, the direction of diversity of land ownership and access in this place. Thank you.
And I think we're just going to take all the questions, and if you can make them succinct, then we'll get as to much as we can. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Vi. It was awesome to hear you guys. I follow some of you on social media. I have a super tangential question, and I hope it's not seen as a challenge, but I'm genuinely interested in continuing the conversation. It's for Dr. Shiva. The continued use of the word peasant woman or peasantry and peasants in India. I'm just curious where that's from, what that's left over from, why it persists, and is it still useful?
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Lewis. I'm an aspiring environmental educator, and Dr. Maria, I'm a huge fan of your music, and I'm just amazed that you're able to do medicine and science and art and all these amazing things for a better world. That's great. I had a question about land ownership, and I read a study on Cuba's transition from industrial agriculture to organic, small-scale local agriculture, and a big part that stuck out to me was that, you know, huge plantations were divvied up, and the government said, like, hey, if you know how to grow food, if you have this knowledge, here's some land to do it. And I'm just curious if any of you have any stories about, you know, that kind of thing or something similar of restoring land back to the people internationally and, you know, strategies for that success. It's just anything in that realm I'm super, super curious to learn more about. Thank you.
Hello.
Hi, my name is Brenda Quintero. I'm the grateful steward of a permaculture farm in Lake County, California. And I was hoping that you could restate the name of the agency that trains farmers to be political activists or political figures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can do that really quickly. So it's called the School of Political Leadership from the HEAL Food Alliance.
Hi, just slipping in the last minute,
whoa,
Michelle.
Right.
Sorry.
I didn't even see you.
I didn't want to come from up front and go all the way around.
Ninja.
Yeah, so, my name is Michelle Magdalena. I'm a dear friend of Maria's. Honored to be standing here in front of you. Thank you so much for coming, everybody. And my question was about the commons and water. I'm very concerned about water in California. And I work a lot with the Run for Salmon up in Shasta. And I see that water coming here and going to the valley and going down to LA, and I feel like we're just recovering from drought here, and it's like time for seeds, and I'm stoked on trees. But when we're talking about dismantling these huge food system agriculture in the valley that's feeding the country, and you know, California feeds the country, it really does. And so, what can you say about like trying to create commons for water, but also food security?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Lots of questions. I was wanting to give maybe the first go to Kristen. Anything coming up for you? On response? Or not. It's all good.
I guess I probably can speak to the land ownership and just in terms of seeing maybe some innovative models, like some farmers in my area wanted to propose like a type of co-housing model for cooperative land ownership, because for us in California, the price per acre is at such a premium for small parcels of land, which is what a lot of like my peers were looking for, kind of the same approximate scale. But as you get into those larger parcels that are being turned over from things, you know, walnuts, almonds, canning tomatoes, that it's not necessarily one farmer wants to take on suddenly 40 to 50 times what they're farming currently. So looking at, the need for a lot better cooperative farming models than exist. But that is the type of lift that does need the policy work to happen simultaneously, because if you look at successful cooperative farming models and cooperative land ownership models, a lot of them have just honestly been dismantled because of, predatory lending or lack of capitalizing, lack of financing at different times, or just outright land grabs. And so you have things like, New Communities Incorporated in Georgia was, the largest black-owned cooperative land project. And just through two periods of drought and through lack of lending, the state was able to take that back, or Japanese internment all around the country basically being a way to dismantle really robust Japanese farming community, and a really integral part of the farming economy got shifted over to benefit white farmers. So, I would say that the need is there to have farmer-owned cooperatives all owning land mutually. Oh, but I do think, too, there's something about rematriating land as well that looks to just like the Catholic Church being the largest landowner, and that there are a lot of radical nuns, I suppose, that have talked about working in tandem with indigenous communities in, on this landmass to do that. And so I think there's a lot of inspiring movement around that, and that, should ultimately be all of our goal.
Yes.
For sure.
Thank you.
I think around the food system idea, just like the procurement chain. Alameda County is piloting this program called Alameda All In, where they're going to start food pharmacies at every county clinic. They want to source only regenerative organic food. And so I would say if you are a small farmer and have a clinic near you, one of the novel things that we're trying to do is to get Medi-Cal and Medicaid to pay for that food and to have it as something that we can prescribe as doctors. So if that is the case, or if that could be developed in partnership between farmers and your local clinics, you guys could have a steady income stream coming from serving people who are in need, healthy food paid for by our government. There you go.
Yeah, so Kerala is one among the, I think, six states we work with. And we've actually written a policy, organic policy in Kerala. And it has a women's cooperative of 4 million members. That's part of our Women's Food Sovereignty Alliance nationally. And I think this link, I mean, this is the issue I was saying about relationship, that the day we connect small farms and health and the rights of every child to have healthy food, we've solved the multiple crises, the crisis of health, the crisis of disappearance farm, the crisis of the death of soils. And this then means to the commons we add food as a commons. Yeah? And I have always said food is the currency of life. What moves between species is food. But we don't see that as the main currency of life that moves in human society. So you've actually achieved food deserts. And my radical imagination is we should see an end of food deserts within the next 5 years. Mm. They have no place to be. Yeah. And this is connected very much to the issue of scale. Because you can't do real ecological work beyond a certain scale. Care is what decides the scale. After that, you have to enter careless technologies. The spraying, the roundup, the drone, the giant machines. And I think we have to start privileging the small scale as the health situation, and the other as the disease-creating system.
Exactly.
Yeah. So this link between small farms and the health system and public feeding programs can be the single biggest shift, because if you add the subsidies and you add the support to feed the poor with junk food, that's a big amount of public money. It's our tax money. We've got to reclaim our tax money as a commons. Yeah? Can't be left to the billionaires to get more concessions and more concessions. 80% of the food that's eaten in the world is brought by small farms. And yet we keep trampling them and expanding the large farms in the name of feeding the world. And it doesn't. There was a question on peasants. Yeah, peasant was a very current word. But there have been too many conflicts between what word to use. And right now I'm fighting a law in India, seed bill, one more attempt to make local seed saving illegal. And suddenly the word farmer has defined, it doesn't have to be anyone who farms. It could be a corporation. Monsanto could be a farmer. So two things, no matter what we do, we must define whatever we call a farmer or peasant, the one who actually works the land and works it with the positive care. You know, not to destroy the land, but to regenerate it. And that's why I think, you know, there's something special about Indian culture. We never gave one name. The Ganga has 1,000 names. The divine goddess has 1,000 names. Lalita Sahasranam. You know, we realize that you have to have diversity to not fight over fixed names or pretending they're fixed entities in the world. You know, so let's give more and more names to whatever we are trying to do. Yeah. On Cuba, it was a crisis that gave birth to Organic Cuba. It's when the trade sanctions prevented tractors, fertilizers from reaching Cuba. They had to shift immediately to animal energy. They had to shift immediately to organic. And I think it is probably the only country which did it so well, because they moved their entire scientific research system overnight to, in the service of organic. Everywhere else I knew, organic grew by individuals who were a bit crazy to realize they could do the right thing. Yeah. The system never supported them. On the commons of water, like food, water is the other living system that moves. It has to be a commons because there is no way you can fix it. Your pollution becomes my pollution. And I think yesterday it was passed that pesticides and fertilizers can be put into water systems without...
The Clean Water Act was reduced.
Yep. Now that's something that should be fought against. But given that we are in such a bad time of hate and Islamophobia, when I wrote my book, Water Wars, and I looked at all the different cultures and how they treated water as a commons, you know what the water in the Middle, what the law for water in the Arab world is?
Sharia teaches us to be a little humble. Yeah. Because we just identify Sharia as an Islamic fundamentalist law. It's the way of water.
Thank you all so much. Thank you, Kristen, Rupa, Vandana. Please give some love. Thank you all for showing up.
I'm so excited today, everyone. So honored to meet you.